edition of the Hagman Report. I'll tell you something, if you, for all of your survival needs, communication needs, as well as night vision, we highly recommend, of course, if you look on the screen, Ready-Made Resources. Bob Griswold is the guy. Ready-Made Resources is the company. 800-627-3809. That's 800-627-3809. Contact him and definitely order your product. There's nothing that I've seen there that's cheap. Okay. When I say cheap, cheaply made, I'm talking about inferior products. Everything that Robert Griswold has that I've seen is 100%. And he knows, I've got to tell you, he knows how to do things right, and he does things right. So there it is, and we thank him for his time tonight. Let me ask you a question. You remember, everyone should remember Pablo Escobar, right? He was the king of cocaine, known as the king of cocaine, wealthiest and most violent criminal in the world. By the 1980s, his Medellin drug cartel was responsible for smuggling several tons of cocaine into America. Think about that, several tons.
$600 million worth a week.
Yeah, it's incredible. And that was responsible for killing thousands of people. And of course, that created, or was responsible for, the Money Laundering Act of 1986. The goal was to take the profit out of Pablo Escobar's business. And the plan was working. Drug money seizures went up. But as U.S. agents became more and more efficient at finding the dirty cash stashed inside, ship bellies and the hidden places and tractor trailers and such, The Pablo Escobar and other cartel members, leaders, sought a more efficient method to get their money back into Colombia. By the way, they found a solution in an unlikely place. And to discuss this, because this, remember, past is prologue. What we're seeing take place today. You might think, well, what is the relevance today to what we saw in the 80s with Pablo Escobar? It's happening. It's over and over again. The playbook is the same. And so with us to talk about his book and really a lot more is Patrick Burns. He's a former U.S. Marine. Now, I got to tell you, he's actually, we got him. Right now, he's on the ground in the Philippines. And so that's, this is truly a program with international reach. But Patrick Burns is going to be coming up here momentarily. He's a former U.S. Marine. He's a retired U.S. special agent and a writer. And a doggone great one at that. His book, The Coin Story, is a required read. Let me tell you, it's not based on a true story. It is a true story. But Mr. Burns has investigated criminals and terrorists throughout the world, including leading an anti-terrorist operation during Operation Iraqi Freedom. Anti-terrorist unit in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom. Sometimes I get ahead of myself there. He's the author of The Coin Store. Again, I'm telling you, you got to read this book. This is a fantastic journal, a story. It's a true story of drug cartels, mobsters, cops, and agents. It's an amazing story about an ingenious billion-dollar worldwide money laundering scheme that swapped stolen mob gold. Think about this. Stolen mob gold for Pablo Escobar's dirty cash. And it's a great story. And it's a good thing Pat Burns plowed ahead during his, he's going to talk about this because this has got so many twists and turns to it. But again, the relevance is it's ever relevant today because we're seeing the same thing happen today. Different actors, different players, but some of the same tactics. And with us to expose what's really going on and talk about what went on is Mr. Patrick Burns. Mr. Burns, thanks so much for joining the Hagman Report tonight.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's our distinct pleasure. Just to let you know, we can hear you just fine and we can see you fine. And coming from the Philippines, I want to thank you for joining us. Where in this case, where would you like to start? Because you're the author of The Coin Store, Okay, a true story of drug cartels, mobsters, cops, and agents. You want to talk about this, about writing this book and how you kind of got started in writing this book and what it's, this book is based on, or do you want to go somewhere else? I'm going to leave that up to you.
Well, the book, the reason I wrote the book is because after finishing the case, everywhere I would go, when people, they had all seen it on the, covered on the news, big little segments of it, and everyone would want to know, tell us about the case. Oh, and when they would hear about it, they'd be, you know, I'd be at a wedding or wherever, and they'd be entertained for 2 hours while I told them, you know, about this very complicated case. And they would say, oh, you should write a book, this should be a movie, and it turned into my lifelong goal to someday, if I can't find someone else to write it, I'll write it myself. And that's what ended up happening. I ended up writing it myself.
Yeah, and so you did, and I've got to tell you, I enjoyed it as an, from just a, even from a lay perspective, but especially as an investigator, I just loved the way, I love your writing style, and of course the information. But well, okay, so what is, for those unfamiliar, what's this book all about? Just let's start there.
It's about, like you said, it's a true story, and it's true. I mean, there's even quotes from the actual gangsters and the cartel people that we recorded on hidden wires on the phones and in the businesses. So you really get a good picture of who these people are from the inside, from their own voices. And it's a story about this this gangster that was in Providence, Rhode Island, and he grew up actually near me, a few miles away, and he was the same age as me. We never met as kids, but he ended up, he's the main person in the story. His code names were Fat Man and Mr. Cash, depending on who he was dealing with. But when he was, when he got started in the business, he was a high school dropout, and his father had taken him. He turned into like a local legend before long, but he started out as like this little chubby kid who liked to collect coins. And And after he dropped out of school, his father decided to take him down to find a job, and he took him to a coin store. And the old man that owned the store gave him a job and tried to teach him the business, but Fat Man decided it was more profitable stealing the inventory than learning the business, which, so he eventually got fired for stealing all the inventory. And that was his first brush with getting into the life of crime. And after that, a suspicious fire burned down the old man's store. And Fat Man opened up his own store and with no competition. And I believe he probably opened it up with the coins he stole from the old man. But that was his, how he started off as like a teenager. He became a thief, and then the mafia started fencing their gold through him, and he actually had like the franchise for stolen gold in Rhode Island. And for a decade, he operated doing that efficiently, and, he was just at home with the mobsters, and he even bought his own refinery, so if the stolen family heirlooms came in one day, he would have it melted by the end of the day, and police would never be able to catch him.
Wait a second. Actually, I'm just trying to get this picture this in my mind. He actually bought his own refinery, so he melted down the gold that, boy, that's a one-stop shop, isn't it?
He had two locations in Rhode Island at the beginning. Eventually, he expanded across the country. But when he began, he had two locations. One was a little fake storefront that had a oversized Roman coin above the door to give everyone the impression it was actually a coin store, which it wasn't. And the stolen gold would come in through the back door, and his employees would record all the transactions and codes. Like, everyone had a code name that brought gold, and no real names were used. If a guy thief drove a Pinto, it would be Joe Pinto or the Ferret or whoever. They all had code names. So if any police even broke in, all they would find were a bunch of coded records.
Yeah, my name would be Doug Hugo, okay? But anyway, go ahead. Sorry about that.
So, and after it came in the back door, and we even recorded some of these robberies coming in the back door, because we had eventually electronic monitoring, and I actually saw it happen. So after it came in the back door, he would have his people drive it about a mile down the road to a refinery, where they had refinery workers that would melt all these incriminating pieces of gold into unrecognizable lumps of gold that are no longer of any evidence value. So he was untouchable, and the local police all knew it, but he was just too good for them. So He operated for like a decade doing it that way. And at one point, after being an untouchable like local hero there in the fencing operation, he decided to expand and go to New York. And what enabled him to actually become so successful in Rhode Island was the fact that Federal Hill was the headquarters for the New England Mafia. So they controlled the underground gold business, and they you couldn't operate without their blessing, and he had their blessing. So he had like a monopoly, a franchise, and nobody else could just start doing it without their approval. So that was one thing he had going for himself. He also had the fact that Providence was a hub for jewelry, the legitimate jewelry business. So there was a constant demand for gold. So he had the opportunity with the mob to get the stolen gold, and he had plenty of people to sell it to get rid of it through his coin store. So essentially, he was laundering gold for the mafia for a decade before he began laundering money for the cartel. And when he went to New York to expand his gold business, he ran into someone for the cartel. And they had a problem that was actually unique to his business. Well, they had all this cash that they had to dispose of because it was incriminating to have this cash, and they needed to get it back to Colombia. Well, he had an opposite problem with the stolen gold. The thieves don't want to be paid with cash. Don't want to be paid with checks. They want to be paid with cash. So the thieves needed cash, and the cartel wanted to get rid of cash. So it was perfect for him to be the middleman. So he made a profit on both. And he became, he was already a millionaire, but he became a multimillionaire. And the scheme also reduced the risk because it avoided or minimized the use of banks for depositing the cash. The banking system...
If I could stop you right there, because you said something pretty profound, and I think we're seeing this today. A lot of people really don't... What you described was essentially money laundering, and a lot of people really don't understand what money laundering is or what it is, and why do people like mobsters and drug traffickers, why do they do it? And I think that's so relevant. If you don't mind, for those people unfamiliar with exactly what money laundering is, and I know okay. that, sorry for kind of going to the investigative 101 here, but I really, really think that it's an important point. So if you can just go over that.
Yeah, sure. It is elusive what it really means, but actually what it means is it's any method used to get that to conceal the money so they can get it out of the country. Because once they collect truckloads of cash from the cocaine sales and it's sitting in America, if they put it in a warehouse or put it in a bank account, it's at risk and they can't use it. They need to get it someplace safe, at least if not in Colombia, someplace else. But the problem with doing that is if you put it in a, which they do all them, every single method you can think of, they do. They have mules that will eat the money just like they eat the cocaine. They'll have boats. They'll have trucks. They'll hide it with tomatoes. But the most efficient method, the quickest way with the least risk, is actually if you can get it into a bank. Because once you get into a bank, you can wire transfer $50 million in an instant anywhere in the world so that no one's going to stop it once it's in the bank. So the trick, though, is how do you get it into the bank without the government seeing it? That's why you need a middleman, someone that either has a legitimate business or at least has the appearance of a legitimate business. And that's why Fat Man was in the perfect position. Not only was he in a business that had the appearance of being legitimate, because it wasn't, but it was deemed to be a cash business. So he had an explanation of why he's depositing all this cash, if anyone would start looking, which eventually I did.
And by the way, I have to say that was an excellent explanation. And folks, our guest is Patrick Burns. He's up there, Donnie Brasco, Joe Pistone. I mean, this is fantastic. His book is The Coin Store. You can find it on Amazon. But I'm sorry, sir. I just want to make sure that people... people had knew the name of your book, The Coin Store, True Story of Drug Cartels, Mobsters, Cops, and Agents. So go ahead, continue, sir.
Oh, so it's really a simple crime. It's the fact that you're concealing the ownership or the origin of drug money for the purpose of getting it somewhere, you know, out of the country. But when they write the law, it's not so simple. You have to actually prove that everyone knew what they were doing. You have to prove they all believed it was drug money, not just it was any illegal money. You have to actually prove to the jurors that it was drug money and that everyone knew it who you charged and that they actually moved the money. So that's part of the book, too, showing how difficult it was to prove it and all of the different tactics that we used, and some of them were traditional, some of them not so much. And that's what the book is, showing that although we had a tip and everyone would think, oh, there's a guy walking in with a duffel bag full of money, he looks like a car thief, that's easy proof, right? No, it's not easy proof. It's 3 years of actually proving that they all knew.
How do you go about now, I know each case is different, but man, that's a task by itself. I mean, you're a legitimate agent. You've got a legitimate task. You're not framing somebody. It's not some 60-year-old man who saved all his life and threw money under a mattress and going in and, you know, buying a car or a house or whatever. So how do you prove that?
Matter of fact, when I did this case, and I say I because at first it was only me. I worked on it for about a year before I proved to everyone that I actually had a big money laundering case. Eventually there were other agencies, but when I say I, it was me at the beginning, but hundreds of agents by the end. So anyway, how do you prove it? I really didn't know yet. This was my first case. I was assigned the case only because the office supervisor thought it was a dead case, that there was nothing there, but he gave it to me kind of like keep busy work. He had already offered it to his senior agents who all refused it. They said, we know that guy. He's a mobster. He's in the gold business. It's a cash business. Just because he brought some money into the banks, it's nothing. It's just his usual routine. So there's nothing there. We're not interested. Give it to the new guy. He's got nothing to do. So that's what happened. They gave it to the new guy. And then every time I would find something incriminating, they would say, he's just an overzealous new guy. You know, they're all like that. You know, I would go to the bank and say, ask them, the tellers, where does money come from? And the teller would say, well, this guy came in with a duffel bag full of $50,000. And I show her a picture. She said, yeah, that's him. And the picture looked like a car thief. And, you know, I'd say, does this look like a president of a company? No, it doesn't. She'd laugh, but, you know, we can't discriminate what people look like. So I would report to the senior agent, say, this guy looks like a car thief. And they'd say, you can't charge anyone with looking like a car thief. And then I would, you know, follow up on where his address was and where his business address was supposed to be. And this is not the coin store, because this is one of his employees who purported to have his own gold business. I would go there, and it would be a house, not a business. There'd be no customers. There'd be nothing to support him making $50,000. And each time, and I would report it to the senior agents, I'd say, hey, this guy doesn't even have an office. They'd say, he's probably an in-home office. There's no crime in that. So like every time I would turn something up suspicious, they'd have an explanation for him saying, you know, why there's nothing there. And that went on for like about a year.
Did the senior agents, did they give you this case or these cases, plural, all being part of the one case, simply because they thought you couldn't handle it, you couldn't figure it out, busy work? What was their purpose of shoving this on you?
They thought there was nothing there, and I was a new agent, so I had no work. So they said, give it to Pat Burns. He's got no cases. He's not going to make a case on this, but at least he can get some practice. You know, he can go talk to some people, and eventually he'll close it. But the thing is, I never closed it.
Okay. And see, folks, this is where it gets good. So, yeah, okay, so that's where you're at with this. Now, this time period is what? Back in the... Remind
this
me.
This is 1988 is when I started it. 1991 is when the arrest happened nationwide in America. And then that's also when I pursued him through Europe, because he fled the country, and then there was a pursuit at the end.
Okay. Well, I don't want to get ahead of you or ahead of ourselves. Yeah. So go ahead and continue. This is fascinating. And folks, I'm telling you, this is, this has got present-day implications. Go ahead, sir.
So So I would talk to my supervisor. I'd say, I have all these indications that there's really something here. And he would say, yeah, I'm starting to think maybe you're right. But, you know, we can't prove that he's laundering money for one thing. You have to prove that, you have to prove that someone moved an amount of cash. They knew it was drug money and actually came from drug money. You know, you don't have any proof that this money came from drugs. You just have a bank report saying, large amounts of cash came in. So I said, oh, well, I guess I'll have to try to prove that it came from drugs. So I obtained an undercover van and put, like, electric company stickers on the side, and I parked it out near his refinery. And eventually I started seeing these criminals coming and going at the refinery after armored trucks would arrive. And we would follow them, these criminals, to the banks, and they make big deposits. So we would report that to the supervisor. He'd say, yeah, it seems like something's awry there, but you still can't prove that those containers actually had the cash, because we got the records from Brinks, and it said that it contained gold. So, you know, just because we suspected the containers had cash, we can't prove it yet. What you need to do is get a search warrant. So how do you do that? You have to convince a judge now. Well, one of the things I started doing was going through the trash at the refinery. So every midnight, every week, I'd be in this dumpster diving. And most of the nights, there was nothing.
Been there. Dumpster diving at midnight. I know the... Okay, go. And folks, you got to experience that. You got to experience it. Mr. Burns, it's a fun deal. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I would get into the dumpster, and I explained earlier in the book that I didn't know it, but this guy, my on-the-job instructor, you know, he had told me earlier that he never carries his gun, but I didn't think he meant ever outside the office. I thought he meant in the office. Anyway, well, I'm in the dumpster one night, and all of a sudden the car pulls up, and there's people around the dumpster, and I'm worried what's about to happen at this mafia-controlled dumpster, you know. And when I call him, on the radio, he whispers, I can't come help you. I don't have my gun. And I say, what do you mean you don't have your gun? And I'm sitting there in this dark dumpster with these criminals floating around the business. I've got my gun pointed at them, and I got no help. But eventually they left, and it's kind of a funny part of the book. But anyway, through the dumpster, I started covering what things that I needed. I found at one point a green accountant work paper that had coded entries that blue was code name for one person, brought in $50,000 from Loomis on so-and-so date, deposit to bank number one, Hover did this, bank number two, and so on. Greek one, Greek two, they all had their code names, but we had to figure out later which one was, and we did. And then I found corners of $20 bills, Brinks receipts, and eventually it was like I had the whole business on a spreadsheet, you know, on a display board to bring into the supervisor and say, well, I got rubber bands, corners of $20 bills, Brinks receipts. I think there's cash in those cans. He says, I think so too, but you still can't prove it. You need a search warrant. So I used that and I obtained a search warrant. And then I could go search those containers. Now, that's only the proof that there's cash in those cans. It doesn't prove all the other elements. So that's why part of this book shows you how difficult it was to actually prove this case. It was almost impossible. So I had to apply for a search warrant. So there were options there. Options there that I explained in the book.
Now, we have got about a minute left until the bottom of the hour network break. So now, okay, and then, of course, you're going to continue on the other side of the network break, but, so you're doing your job right, and I want to ask you this question. Did you ever find shredded, were shredders in use back in the 80s, back at that time? Did you ever have to, like, piece shredded papers
together? They had shredders in those days. But this was a refinery. The guy that was running it was supposed to throw that stuff in the furnace. The only reason I found it was he was too lazy. So that's most of the time I would go there, there'd be nothing in it. I would dive in the dumpster and come up empty-handed. But once in a while, when he was in a hurry to go out, he would throw it in there and I would find it.
Isn't that something? The laziness of the mobs or the criminals is,
yeah,
that's amazing. Folks, we're talking with Mr. Patrick Burns. He's the author of The Coin Store. Folks, in fact, go to Amazon right now and order your copy of The Coin Store, True Story of Drug Cartels, Mobsters, Cops, and Agents. It's a fantastic book. I love it. It's a great read. Patrick Burns is our guest, and of course, he is a former U.S. Marine, retired U.S. Special Agent, and he's talking about his work in exposing one of the largest. Yes. Would you say one of the largest?
One of the absolutely the largest.
Yeah.
I mean, and
they're the largest.
Yeah.
Some of the figures, you know, the TV show that's real popular now, there's two of them on Netflix. One is called Narcos. The other one is called El Chapo. And in those, they detail... and historically, it's detailed how much money that these drug cartels were making. And, I mean, they were making billions of dollars a month. They were making more money than the top five corporations in the U.S. were.
In some countries.
Just by trafficking cocaine. Absolutely. To the point where they needed other countries and the country's leaders, like Manuel Noriega, to get involved in the laundering. And the ways that, the creative ways that they had to come up with to stay ahead of law enforcement are fascinating when you get into them. But we're going to continue to talk with Mr. Patrick Burns on the other side. Want to give a shout out to Bill McIntosh from Ocaso Media for setting up this interview. He always brings on great guests. Again, that is Ocaso Media.
Yeah, use them for any type of speaking that need you might have.
Absolutely. When we come back, we're going to continue to talk with Mr. Burns about his book and about his experience and experiences in stopping the laundering of money and how this all works and worked behind the scenes. We'll be right back after these messages. Don't go anywhere.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
Shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. No, nor ever shall be.
Folks, I'm going to direct your attention to MasterPreps.com. MasterPreps.com.
Wow.
MasterPreps.com, the sponsor of our show, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Take a visit there. High-quality items, made-in-America items. I mean, anything, everything you possibly want, from cooking utensils, cooking frying pans. It'll blow you away. Absolutely, Eric said.
It's insane. I mean, wow. Look at the products.
Folks, visit MasterPreps.com. Again, welcome to the Hagman and Hagman Report family. MasterPreps.com. I mean, wow. It's insane.
MasterPreps.com. Are you ready for what comes next?
Hi, I'm Grace Gonzalez from Trang Post in the Woods. We are an American family-owned company founded and built on skills and knowledge gained from responding to 18 major disasters in the U.S. and around the world. We found that most people don't have enough food and water to survive, let alone any medicinals to save their life. We're offering 25% off our must-have American Heritage Remedies kit. It contains 12 homeopathic remedies, a booklet that goes over everything in your kit, and our brand new book, Major Disasters, Lessons Learned. Just enter coupon code HAGMAN. In life or a disaster, you must be able to take care of yourself. You may not be a medical doctor, and your grandmother and your great-grandmother probably weren't either. But they still knew how to minister to their family's health issues. And so can you. Check out our American Heritage Remedies Kit at www.changecoastofwoods.com. Your life may depend on it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Charles, the guy whose voice is heard announcing for the Hagman and Hagman Report right here on YouTube and across the Global Star Radio Network. There have been many people wondering whose music is being played during those breaks. Well, you guessed it. And we're very pleased to announce that all that music and 11 brand new songs from the CD New Jerusalem is set for release on April 10th for download on iTunes. ways you can help support my ministry and be blessed by this awesome, inspiring recording. I have been fortunate to work with some phenomenal musicians from around the world that helped us put this recording together in the studio. Simply go to joecharlesmusic.com and click on the iTunes link. Or, if you'd rather have a CD, we'll send one right out to you. Just leave me your email and we'll get right back to you. And thanks to Doug and Joe Hagman for making this all possible. God bless.
This is the Hagman Report. What an interesting guest we have, Mr. Patrick Burns. He's a retired U.S. special agent. And we're talking about, among other things, well, we're talking about his book, The Coin Store, which is a fascinating read. It's all about money laundering. It's about the case ultimately that he worked on with respect to Pablo Escobar, well before anyone who knew who El Chapo was. And I want a very special thank you to Bill McIntosh of Casa Media. If you need a speaker for your event, whether it's a church, regardless of the venue, contact Bill McIntosh. Especially for conference speakers. My goodness, Bill McIntosh is the man. Book an Acosta Media speaker today. Call 305-396-2806. That's 305-396-2806. But do it after the show. And again, we want to thank Bill McIntosh. U.S. Special Agent Patrick Burns is our guest. The Coin Store is the title of the book. Got a lot of... I'll tell you something. That you can't make this stuff up. So, Joe, during the break, he kind of related a kind of an interesting, I don't want to say, an interesting event. You want to take it? You want to talk to him? Open it up?
Well, sure. And you're talking about the coin store and how you came about to introduce yourself to these people.
Now imagine that.
Walking right in there, Mr. Burns, tell us about after you're doing the surveillance, what tactic you decided to use moving forward in this investigation.
All right, sure. I had already gathered all the video of all the trucks showing, the courier showing, the bank deposits. So I had established that there was cash in these containers, but there's several elements to this crime, and after meeting with the U.S. Attorney's Office, besides not connecting yet to drugs, we hadn't proved that the bad guys at the coin store, we hadn't proved that they knew where the money came from drugs. I'm sure they did know, but we hadn't proved it. They hadn't said anything on the phone calls that we recorded or said anything in the business that we recorded, because we had listening devices on all the phones and all the businesses. So they hadn't said anything that would incriminate them, because if we had arrested the people in the coin store, the crew, all they would have to do is come to court and say, I don't know where the money came from. Sure, it was a lot of money, but gold's the cash business. The boss sends it to me from New York. How would I know where it comes from? And they'd be found innocent. So the trick was, how do we get these guys to talk about... talk about something that shows they know it's illegal drug money. That's not easy. So what I decided to do is, I had nothing to lose. I'm just going to, now this is 2 years into the investigation, we still hadn't proved they knew anything, because all the phone calls were all coded. They would never talk about drugs, never talk about cash. If they had a $250,000 in 20s coming, they would call it a low grade. The boss would say, I'm going to send you some low grade. They never say cash. So anyway, we had to prove that the guys working behind the counter in the coin store knew what they were doing and knew it was drug money. So I decided, I'm just going to go in there and do, it would be a ruse, and just they call it tickling the wire. I'm going to go in there and get them to generate some talk about why I'm there. And I'm going to drop some names of the people that are moving a lot of the money to make sure that they feel like I'm onto their trail, because I want to stir it up as much as I can. So that's what I did. So I drove to the coin store, and while I'm doing that, we have a team that's at an undercover location that's sitting there listening to the phone calls and the conversations within the coin store, and they hear me arrive. So there's a couple of the players that are behind the bulletproof glass, and I start asking questions about some of the people I know that have gone to the banks. And they say, oh, he's not here, he's not here. And then one of the guys starts walking away, trying to avoid any further conversation. So I happened to bang on the glass. I said, hey, I'm not done with you. And he keeps walking. Eventually I'm punching the glass to show him that I'm serious. And he jumps and gets a little fidgety. And he changes his tune and then answers my question. But the reason I mention that is because they're going to talk about that incident later. So
okay.
After I feel like I've planted enough seeds in their minds, I leave. Now, on my drive back to the undercover site, they start talking. One of them says, you know why, he says, oh, you know, Steve's going to be sunning his fat ass on the beach. Well, we're all in the can. Another guy starts calling his friends, don't answer the phone. He tells them, don't this, Burns is here. Now, the guy that I yelled at, he talks to this older guy, and he's kind of like shook up. And the older guy's kind of like comforting him. He's an old gangster. He's rubbing him on his shoulder, saying, don't worry about it, kid. When a guy gets his badge, it's like being a made man. He's got a whole crew behind him. It's nothing personal. Relax. Don't worry about it. And the guy that I yelled at says, well, I'm going to kill that bastard if he ever comes back here again. And then they keep recording the phone calls, and people are saying, well, we don't want him to find out the pipeline to New York. We don't want to do this. All of their explanations for how they're going to talk their way out of this are all being recorded. But the best one comes at the end. The old guy's talking to the younger guy who I yelled at, and he says, you know why Burns was here, don't you? And the young guy says, no. The old guy says, it's not the gold. And he lowers his voice to a whisper as if a microphone can only pick up loud voices. Because he's concerned about microphones. But he says, it's not the gold, it's the money washing. He whispers, money washing. Bang. That's it. I couldn't have asked for anything better. That was
wow.
That was how we showed they knew what they were doing in the coin store.
But just to go back, because I certainly don't want to understate what you did. And folks, imagine this: 2 years into the investigation, you got nothing. So you go in, tickling the wire, as you put it, go in there, pound on the glass. You identified yourself as a U.S. agent, right? I mean,
right.
And said, this is what, you know, we're looking at. I just want you to imagine that scenario and Mr. Burns, being the one doing that, really pushing the envelope there. And then, of course, the fruit of your labor being in that one phrase. Okay, so I just didn't want to understate what you did, because that takes a lot of wow. It takes a lot to do that. So okay, so you got enough then, right? I mean, that worked.
No. We proved the knowledge. We still didn't prove the drugs yet. We seized no drugs, and they haven't talked about drugs. That's not gonna. We're gonna end up going to trial. I don't want to get ahead of the story here. That's the drug element's still not proved, and I explain why, and that's something that keeps hanging all the way through the book, which you have to read till the end to figure out how that happened. But I can tell you another very interesting twist in the story. At one point, we had that admission about the knowledge, and we had cameras that were facing the back of their business to watch the thieves bringing in the gold and the couriers bringing in the money, and it was hidden in a school stadium. So there was like a hole cut out of a closet door faced towards the coin store. Well, one night, some kids are hanging around the stadium while it's closed, and they're drinking beers, and they come across, they're walking by this door, and there's a green light that catches one of their eyes, and they look through this hole, and when they look inside, there's electronics. So they break in, and there it is, the FBI's video camera and recorder. And when they push the button to see what's on it, all they see is criminals coming and going from the coin store, and some of them are counting money on the way out the door. So one of the kids says to the other, what do you want to do? And the big one says, I've got an idea. So anyway, the next day, while we're all listening to the conversations, everything's very quiet. Not only have I announced that I'm looking at them, but now something else happened. Well, then finally, when it's all quiet, the fat man decides he's calling a meeting, and it's going to be at a place he knows won't be recorded, because now he's very concerned. So he plans it at his mother's house, who lives down the street, and it's a scene right reminiscent of The Goodfellas, where Joe Pesci goes to see his mother in the middle of the night, little white-haired lady amongst these killers, you know?
So now neat. Yeah, yeah, I got you.
That's exactly what happened. So this whole crew of menagerie of thugs and thieves and criminals, they all show up at this little white-haired lady's house, and they're all sitting in her dainty living room eating fried doughboys and watching a videotape on her new VCR that still has an FBI sticker on it. And as she's passing out doughboys and coffee, these guys, they're not worried. They're all laughing. They're saying, oh, as one of the guys named DeMarco, his code names were Animal and Blue. Well, he's got a big belly, so when they see him come on the screen, they're laughing. Hey, you better eat no more doughboys for you, Blue. And when one of the other guys, Mickey's got long hair, they say, when are you going to cut that hair, Mickey? And they're just making jokes about each other as they're watching the FBI tapes of them. And by the end of the meeting, which wasn't recorded, which that was a smart move, the fat man says, okay, we're going to keep working, but things are going to change. He says, you guys got to get your own lawyers and blah, 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 and just get ready. You know, he gives them all advice. Well, they don't know it, but he's going to take off, so... He leaves them all kind of hanging with that advice and then flees the country. But the meeting itself was just
nice
hilarious.
No? Wow. Okay. Wow. Well, so just to be clear, the kids who found the equipment, and did what? Gave it to the... Sold it to the...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They said, oh, they know where they're going to get paid. They know it's the coin store. They know it's a criminal enterprise. So they, rather than just keep the VCR and the recorder, they knew that they'd get more money if they take it right to the criminals, which is what they did.
Are those kids still sucking air? Are they still walking among us or what?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were helpful to the criminals, so they probably gave them a good bonus. I don't know how much.
Wow. Well, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead and continue. This is fascinating. Patrick Burns is our guest. And, of course, the book, The Coin Store, is the book on Amazon. It's a fascinating story, money laundering. Go ahead, sir. Continue.
So, anyway, the next day, the wire is quiet. All these the players are all saying, where's Steve? Where is he? He usually calls every 10 minutes. Now we don't hear from him. You know, and again, they're turning into these... accusatory conversations, you know, well, he's setting us up, he's this and that, and sure enough, that's what happened. Oh, and the white-haired lady, by the way, besides passing out the doughboys, Fat Man had buried $2 million worth of pure gold in her backyard. So no one knew that. We found it later.
Wow. Okay.
So anyway, as we're trying to record the more conversations, we can see that things are changing, and I went to New York, went to his condo, looked for him, and he was gone. And then eventually it was found out through phone calls and customs that he had gone to London. So that's where the pursuit to London started, and it didn't end there. I don't want to tell the end of the book.
No.
That was only the beginning.
I'm going to tell you, the way this book is written in the end is just fantastic. I'll just say this. Pack your bags, right? Because you're going to chase. Oh, man,
yeah.
Incredible. Okay, tickling the wire in the high stakes chase in Europe to nail the fat man. It's an incredible saga of. I mean, you had me at the first chapter, but by the end of the book, it's just amazing. And you ultimately brought down this group, and of course this is the biggest in the world, right? Measuring up to okay.
Yeah, there had been a very big case called the Operation Polar Cap that was mainly on the West Coast, and when those arrests happened, the cartels that were using them shifted all to Secocia. He kind of became like the last man standing, sort of, in the gold business to launder their money. So his business grew exponentially. Yeah, and when it was originally looked at, the FBI said, as far as they knew, this was the first time they ever saw anyone launder for both cartels, the Cali and the Medellin. And there were estimates that the numbers were up to $1 billion. And I personally seized $50 million out of a Swiss account. We seized a coin store, and actually, after it was sold on the market, a new buyer decided he'd open it up into a flower shop. So that was like a poetic ending to this infamous coin store. And I took a picture of that, before and after. Before my investigation, there's this dark, sinister purported coin store, and at the end is a beautiful new flower shop. So, I mean, that's like something you make up in a fictional movie, but it's, you know, this is nonfiction. It actually happened, and I actually have the pictures of it all.
That's amazing. And you know, many in our audience, we've interviewed Joe Pistone, Donnie Brasco, Serpico. This is right up there. This is right up there. And if you like movies, or if you've seen Goodfellas, or Catch Me If You Can, this is indeed a true crime story. It's, again, it's, as I said in the beginning, it's not just based on a true story. It is a true story. And you can see, it's so incredibly interesting from their own mouths how some of these mobsters were very clever and very savvy, while others were bumbling idiots and morons. But, is there any one incident that you can talk about right now in your pursuit, in this big case, maybe affected you personally? How did it end for you? Because I know that there's a lot of turmoil toward the end. And
oh, yeah. When I started, I mean, this was my first agent job, you know, and when I started, I was ambitious as, you know, and as eager to get to it as anyone. It was like my dream to be an agent. I watched, you know, Elliot Ness on TV when I was a kid, and I wanted to bust through garage doors like him, you know.
But sure.
As I started working at the Treasury under the IRS, it was amazed how discouraging it was. It's like how anyone keeps enthusiasm for 20 years, it's impossible. They tried to close my case even after I proved it was a substantial investigation. The higher ups in Washington tried to close it. They put pressure on my boss and his boss, and when they refused to close it down, they actually fired them. So they could eventually put someone in place directly above me that could put more pressure on me. But by the time they did that, it was actually too late, because there were already too many agencies involved, and it was just too big to stop. And they seemed to like vow that they're going to make everyone pay that did this case, because the IRS doesn't want to do it. The bean counters in Washington D.C. in the basement, they only want to get tax cases. You know, they want to go after the plumbers and the waitresses. That's in their blood, and doing law enforcement is not in their blood. It's actually offensive to them. They want nothing to do with it. So
I find that extremely discouraging and disheartening. Here you are. You've got the biggest case essentially in the world. You're investigating an international money laundering case. You're successful. You're good at it. People above you should be very happy, I would think, but they're being, instead of encouraging you, they're trying to stop you. And then when they're not successful at it, they get fired and replaced.
Right.
But why? But is it just simply that they want to go after the waitresses and the plumbers and the normal folk and leave the drug? Is there something else? Is there something more nefarious behind this, or that you saw?
No, I don't think it's nefarious. I think that it's just that when you don't make it to the top of the IRS if you're not one of them. You
okay.
know,
yep.
my boss report described it to me as they eat their own. You know, you don't get to the top unless you're one of them. You know, like being King Jong-un, you don't get in his inner circle unless you're one of him. You know, and that's the way it is in the IRS. If you're a law enforcement person, you're never going to get there. They recruit people like themselves to the top positions, and they're comfortable doing tax cases from the office. You don't get any bad publicity. They get bonuses based on tax collected. You know, they get nothing out of spending money on money laundering, which they think is someone else's job, you know, like the FBI can do it or someone else can do it. They don't really get anything out of it personally, and they don't want to do it. It's a liability. And they have absolutely no care about right and wrong and laws. You know, that's not their bag. They don't see themselves as law enforcement. They're tax collectors. Even though they have a small branch of law enforcement agents, you know, that's nothing compared to the overall civilians that are in the agency who run it, you know?
Wow. Okay. And that's kind of discouraging to me, folks. Patrick Burns is our guest for the next 8 or so minutes. His book is The Coin Store, which is a fantastic book. Get it on Amazon. And I want to thank Bill McIntosh from Acosta Media. And if you need any speaker for your event, Acosta Media, this is fascinating. Joe, I know you got a question.
Yeah, Patrick, I want to ask you, did you run into problems, obviously, in cases like this where huge amounts of cash are involved? You have corruption, especially with, we'll talk about Pablo Escobar and the Medellin cartel, with local law enforcement there and the government officials inside of Colombia. Did you guys have any problems internally with people taking kickbacks, bribes, and to look the other way for this activity to continue?
Well, there was absolutely kickbacks, bribes, threats down in Colombia. One of the contact points for Fat Man down in Colombia got a visit from a team of hitmen who, after we made arrest, they came up to his office and they lined up everyone against the wall just like a St. Valentine's Day massacre and just killed everybody, all the witnesses. But before that happened, we had actually done a search in that office, and the police were there, the Colombian police, along with the federal agents from the U.S., and they would allow us to look at certain records, but not other records. It's like, you can look at this guy's, but not this one, you know? So I get some Colombian records, and I actually matched them dollar to dollar for the transactions Fat Man did, but there were others we couldn't get, and that was based on, you know, corruption or threats or payments, whatever, that the cartels would. Too strong for these cops to go against some of them.
And Patrick, if I can, you just mentioned the records. I know that at the height of Pablo Escobar's reign of terror in Colombia, that he was able to infiltrate, with the help of a communist organization, the main court building, destroying just about all the records there. How much of a on all the records there that tied him to drug trafficking and the money laundering, how much of the evidence that you guys were using was destroyed in that breach?
Yeah, we didn't use anything. We didn't get anything from any records from that. We just got records from his money man in Colombia. What was I going to say? Oh, anyway, so that didn't really affect us.
Okay.
But I did speak one of my seizure cases, which is related to this. It was for actually Santa Cruz Londono, one of the higher ups in the Cali cartel. I went to New York to testify at the source of the money. And like you said, there's a lot of records that just didn't exist. Well, when the defense attorney trying to save Londono's money has me on the stand, I'm testifying as a witness. One of the questions he asks is, "You don't know where this money came from." Now, I actually didn't have any proof. All I did was talk to the DEA agent who had worked on there and told me this is Donald's money. So, anyway, I'm on the stand, and the last prosecutor, defense lawyer, says, "You don't know for sure where this money came from, do you?" And I said, "Yeah, I do. It's Londono's." And then he said, "No more questions." He should have asked, "How do you know that?" I would have had to say, "Because Bob told me."
Oh my word!
Wasn't in the Cali cartel? Didn't one of the money men, one of the accountants, the bookkeepers, wasn't he able to escape? And didn't he testify at hundreds of trials that went after these drug lords and the people who took the money?
I'm sure that sounds reasonable, but I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, I thought that's what you were referring to.
This was a Southern District, New York City, seizure of $12 million from the Cali cartel, and Londono had it all these companies, like a flower shop, a fruit stand, all in his relatives' names.
Yeah,
Londono. DEA told me these are all his relatives, that's all his money. And that's all I had it based on, but I testified anyway, hoping for the best, and sure enough, he didn't ask me the right question, so Londono lost $12 million.
For want of a good attorney, or at least, isn't that something? And can you, we have a little problem apparently, historically, in from Mena, Arkansas. Maybe you can go and, this is a serious question though, and I'm being serious when I ask this. Did you run into any Mena, Arkansas overlap here, you know, the drugs flying from south into Arkansas under the what Larry Nichols talks about, help me out, Joe.
Yeah, there was a plane crash of 4 tons of cocaine in Mena, Arkansas.
Yeah, during the Clinton.
Yeah, that was flown in from Latin America.
It would have been the same time period. Did you run any of this overlap?
No. I would have liked to have done an investigation into Hillary Clinton. But I didn't have anything on that.
Well, let's get your butt back to the United States and come on. We got some work to do, my brother. But I do want to say the Coin Store is a fabulous read, and you've got and I'm telling you, you've got nerves of steel, and it's, you're a fantastic investigator, and the stuff that you put up with, even to the extent of just resigning because you know you couldn't do your job anymore. Thank you for everything you've done, and thank you for your service to our country, and in all of your capacities. We really, really appreciate that. And what a fascinating interview, Mr. Burns. Thank you so much. God bless you, my friend. Thanks for taking your time out of your day from the Philippines. Patrick Burns was our guest. The book, The Coin Store, just a fascinating read, and it has really present-day significance. What a great man. Folks, you're listening to The Hagman Report, Global Star Radio Network, Global Star and BTR, of course, YouTube Live. We're going to be right back. The Coin Store. You gotta get that book, man. Good rip.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the Belly of the Beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.